Welcome to the CSense Center podcast. The topic for our podcast today will be COVID-19, which the World Health Organization declared a global emergency on 30th of January. Specifically, in our discussion today, we would like to focus primarily on business continuity and disaster recovery planning. As the human costs escalate and the economic costs is becoming even more evident and ever more significant. My name is Mark McKenzie, a senior financial sector specialist in the Financial Stability and Supervision and Payment and Settlement System workstream at the CSense Center. Our aim of our podcast at the CSense Center is to provide and share information on current topical issues relating to the CSense Center's three core pillars, which are financial stability and supervision, payment and settlement systems, macroeconomics and monetary policy management, leadership and governance. The CSense Center is a thought leader for central banks and monetary authorities in the Southeast Asia and Pacific region. As always, we encourage you to find our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and other major platforms by searching for the CSense podcast. If you like our content, please leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher if you're listening on Android. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at CSense Center, or email us at podcasts@csense.org. if you have any questions or comments. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by two of my distinguished and esteemed colleagues, Mr. Glenn Taskey and Mr. Aziz Durrani, and they will introduce themselves for us. Glenn.
Thanks, Mark. I'm Glenn Taskey, Director of CSense Programs on Financial Stability, Financial Supervision, and Payments. I'd like to first thank my colleagues, Mark and Aziz, for organizing the podcast, and to all the listeners for tuning in. COVID-19 has already taken lives and caused suffering in many countries around the world. The human tragedy should always be first in our minds as financial sector regulators, as we discuss ways to maintain financial stability, of which business continuity management of central banks, standalone financial sector regulatory authorities, deposit insurance agencies, and financial institutions themselves plays a central role. I think we all know that the regulatory authorities are going to have to perform some kind of heroic double duty through this situation. The authorities themselves may need to implement business continuity management, while at the same time, keeping an eye on the regulated financial institutions' implementation of their own business continuity management programs, if indeed they have them at all. Beyond that, the authorities have to keep an eye on the spillover effects from the real economy on their regulated financial institutions, and even consider running some kind of screens to determine which of them are the most exposed to the most affected sectors, such as energy, transport, tourism, and retail. Keeping an eye on the industry while the authorities' own functions are constrained will be a big challenge, intensifying the need for risk-based supervision, and in particular, there's never been a greater need and a more important role for off-site supervision than there is today. Aziz, do you want to continue?
Yeah. Hi everyone, I'm Aziz Durrani, a senior financial sector specialist here at CSense, also focusing on similar areas on financial stability, supervision, and payment and settlement systems. And clearly it's a very sad time at the moment and very distressing as well. We have to trust as best as possible the official guidance we're getting from the health authorities. But it's also a time when our central banks and our member central banks and regulatory authorities need to revisit some of these business continuity and disaster recovery planning statements and plans that have been put in place. in light of this risk we're facing from COVID-19. Now, I remember I was kind of lived through the last financial crisis in 2007-08, and that was stressful enough when we had to try and work out what the response should be and how the financial system should be supported. We are now going through a similar scenario, but obviously we have the overlay of the actual infection as well affecting the health and well-being of ourselves, our families, and businesses across the region. So I think it's a really good time to have this discussion, and I'm looking forward to talking about some of the key considerations and challenges that we should be looking at.
Okay, thank you very much, Aziz. Thank you very much, Glenn. I think you've kind of set the stage for discussion today. But let us see if we can zero in first and foremost on our members, the central banks and the monetary authority first, and then we'll perhaps look a little bit at specifically at the financial services sector, the banking institution as well. So if we could, you know, highlight some key considerations for central banks and regulatory authorities today, as we think about this specific health risk and how we prepare for business continuity and disaster recovery, what would be some of those key considerations? Glenn, would you like to kick us off?
Thanks a lot, Mark. And the first thing I'd like to point out is, as most organizations are adopting some type of business continuity management programs, they're putting them into practice, including our members, central banks and monetary authorities. One of the first pillars of many of these programs is scaling down activities. But in the event that the economic fallout from COVID-19 spills over into generalized weaknesses in the financial sector, then central banks and other regulatory authorities will have to make many, many quick decisions on many fronts. And this is the opposite of scaling down. The regulators may have to meet for long hours, some working from remote locations, to put in effect contingency plans that may be needed to shore up banks' capital, cash supply, liquidity. Some key staff may not even be available remotely if they're undergoing treatment or taking care of family members who are undergoing treatment. Another thing is regulators may also have to meet with directors and officers of financial institutions to discuss and agree on urgent measures. And these meetings may have to be held remotely also. And that's difficult even in the best of times. You know, as we all know as central bankers, face-to-face meetings where you sense the other person's reactions, body language, tone of voice, frank discussions can better take place face-to-face, and these are going to be constrained. And these are going to be some very difficult conversations. Central banks may even find that there are pressures for regulatory relief. Now, pressures on central banks and other regulators to relax regulations exist all the time. They exist even in the best of times. But these pressures may intensify, requiring, again, more meetings, and this time meetings with elected officials such as parliamentarians, you know, members of the cabinet, and so forth in many countries. In fact, regulatory relief and borrower relief have already been implemented in Italy, which is Europe's hardest hit country, as we know. For example, Italy has declared a moratorium on mortgage payments, with the Italian government guaranteeing these payments ultimately. Now, how are these programs going to be implemented by understaffed regulators, and how are their impacts on financial institutions going to be assessed? This is one thing I'm concerned about. What happens, for example, if shortages of staff at banks who are reporting to the regulators result in the reduction in supply of critical data that are needed to make decisions? Many banks, as we all know, are now in the process of preparing their annual financial statements for 2019. Although these statements will not reflect the effect of COVID-19 on their operations, the reports and the auditor's opinions on these reports may be delayed for weeks or even months, along with delays in the transmission of more current data. So central banks and regulators must keep in mind that the data may not be as regularly available as in normal times. It's a good thing, I think, that many of the critical banking functions have been automated in the last few decades, requiring less human involvement. But human involvement is still necessary to screen and flag reports of transactions, do things like turn equipment on and off, maintain equipment, provide security, control access to key infrastructure, and so forth. Bank staff, you mentioned, Mark, cash supply, ATMs. Banks and staff and third-party vendors will still be necessary to keep ATMs functioning. So there is the human element that cannot be automated. Cyber criminals and fraudsters may take advantage of a chaotic situation at one or more financial institutions to strike, believing that management is distracted by issues related to the virus. So we certainly can't take our eye off of the looming risk of cyber attacks, which have been building up in financial services in the last few years.
I could just pause you there for a minute, just to see if I could sum up what I'm hearing from you in terms of some of the key considerations for central bankers, regulatory authorities, within an environment where people are getting sick. They have to take into consideration scaling down their operation. But even within that sense, we're talking about they may have to make quick decisions to address other issues such as, say, capital deficiencies, liquidity, should those arise within this same crisis that is unfolding. Let me just pause it there for a bit and just see if, what are some of your key considerations from a central banker perspective, regulatory authority perspective?
Yeah, thanks, Mark. And I think Glenn has kind of summarized a lot of the issues very well. What I would say is, you know, every time we talk about crisis and crisis management, the key word that comes up is confidence. And the key thing for the central banks to do is maintain the confidence in the system. Now, you know, there's a lot of measures happening. We're seeing on the monetary side, interest rates being cut. On the fiscal side, a lot of additional investments and so on being announced. So that's the kind of right direction. But a lot of those things don't kick in straight away. They will take time to feed into the system. So it's giving us some medium-term confidence that, yes, things will pick up again. The problem is, in the short term, you know, people aren't going out. They're not spending the money. They're not going to go to the cinemas or the holidays and you know, various events. So, you know, airlines and a number of other businesses are going to be greatly impacted. So how do you maintain that confidence that they won't collapse in that interim and give them some additional leeway? So I think some very immediate short-term assistance, which could be in the form of liquidity facilities that's available more directly to the companies. We could look at relaxing regulations such as allowing forbearance on loans. So not counting something as non-performing, you know, giving companies maybe 12 months without penalizing them. On the tax side, you could have more relaxed time to pay agreements so that companies don't have to make their VAT or other tax payments in the same way and have additional time. So there's a lot of those more immediate measures. But I think what will really hit people is, you know, what happens now when some senior public officials start getting coronavirus, right? So in the UK, we had the junior health minister who's now gone down with coronavirus. So now there's a bit of panic. Well, if the health minister themselves is sick, well, you know, how are they going to deal with this? Well, they can't deal with it.
That's an interesting point, because news came out this week, for example, that a deputy governor in Sweden contracted the virus. So does that news bring additional concern from a public confidence perspective?
Right. So yeah, so if the governor of a central bank or even the prime minister or president of a country comes down with it, then that's going to create the panic to say, right, you know, who's actually leading this? So we have to kind of think ahead and assume if something like that does happen, we need people to be able to step up and say, look, it's still all in control. This is the new chain of command. This is our plan. And give some additional reassurance around that.
Excellent. Can we just explore this for a bit? All right. So we're talking about a situation where we may see a scaling down in terms of activities, but we still have to make these quick decisions. We still have to preserve public confidence. So what are some of the steps that we can take to, given that it's human beings that are being affected by this, what are some of the practical steps that central banks could take to ensure that they have the manpower to keep functioning, to keep the confidence in the public systems?
Yeah, I mean, I think I said this at the start, the key change, you know, previously we were looking at how to deal with the crisis, but now the additional impact is, well, it's actually affecting our own health or our family's health, so part of our mind is going to be concerned with that. And then physically, as you said, we may not be able to come into the central bank or the offices. So we need to set up a plan to say, well, actually, we've now got the technology for people to be able to work remotely. Why not use that effectively and, you know, give assurance that we can still carry on doing our work from home. You know, we all have access to the same documents. We can have meetings virtually. So the business is going to continue. Particularly because this is not a short-term impact, it looks like it could carry on for a number of months, wave after wave of severity coming higher and lower. So we need a longer, you know, slightly more longer-term view to how this would work in that sense.
So Glenn, just help me out here. So because when I think about this, I think about, you know, what are those critical systems that we have to ensure that we have the human capacity to continue kind of. So if you were thinking about it, you mentioned earlier the whole thing about getting access to data, important meeting. I mean, what are some additional things that you could think about from that perspective?
Well, I think, you know, the most important critical function is ensuring the smooth running of the payment system. And you know, the payment system is the lubricant of economic transactions in any economy, and any interruption to the payment system, you know, caused either by the unavailability or breakdown of a, you know, central choke point in the system, such as a central bank, you know, or a major financial institution, or outages in IT systems, you know, that may be provided by third-party vendors over which we have not been exercising the right kind of supervision, I think, to me, is the most critical function, and there we already know, because there have been cases where the payment systems in certain countries have broken down, for example, I mean, not for reasons like what we're discussing today, but back in 2013, the payment system in Cyprus broke down because of concerns over the strength of the banks in Cyprus, and moratoriums were placed on deposit withdrawals and things like that. And that caused a significant downturn in economic activity. So preserving the payment system at all costs is really, really vital. And getting back to the issue of confidence, which Aziz brought up, which I thought was very good, we in the CSEN stakeholder space don't often talk about the role of deposit insurance, but it's going to be necessary, I think, for building confidence for deposit insurance systems in different countries to continue to reassure the public that their savings are safe, you know, up to the covered amounts, and that if banks, you know, we hope this doesn't happen in any country, but if banks start to fail or have to be closed or reorganized because of some of the economic impacts that we may see, the deposit insurance agencies should very swiftly pay out the depositors. They'll have to resolve these institutions, troubled institutions, faster than would otherwise be required, just so that the depositors will have access to their money.
Yeah, excellent. Aziz, do you any?
I think the payments infrastructure is key, but I think that people are also going to be worried about actually what is happening with their job if they can't go into the office.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of contractors these days and people on short-term contracts or even daily contracts. So there'll be a lot of fear there. So again, this goes outside of the remit of just the central bank, but in a coordinated way, some additional assurance of what will happen with them. I think, you know, if you think about it, if you are someone who's driving a Grab car, if you don't go to work, you won't get paid. You're likely to continue working even if you are ill, and that's going to continue spreading. So again, the measures that the central banks, the more liquidity, the more support that they can offer to businesses, the more likely it is that businesses can continue functioning through this difficulty and allow their employees to take some time out. But obviously, I think that's when the government also needs to get involved and provide some statutory sick pay, or if you're diagnosed with the virus, then you automatically qualify for some payments. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it'll keep on escalating.
All right. So, I mean, you both mentioned the payment systems, and I believe the Committee for Payments and Market Infrastructure, they have a framework in terms of contingency planning for payment systems, and it's critical to have backup systems, recovery sites in place. Would this be a time for recovery sites to be activated, and does it help in terms of the risk that we're trying to manage?
Well, I do think that's an excellent question, Mark. I do think that they need to be contested. Parallel runs between the recovery centers and the main central bank operations should be conducted. I don't think in many places that, you know, full disaster recovery has to be implemented yet. But everybody has to be ready for these programs to be activated. Reminding people, you know, what their key roles are if the central bank had to go on a you know, program of much reduced staff and scaling down, who assigning roles to people in the event that a key person is disabled, for example, I think is critical. And these things can be done now.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Aziz?
Yeah, I mean, I think a number of banks are already putting into action their recovery sites. But here's where we have the real challenge, because these recovery sites were, mainly set up with a view that there's some kind of terrorist action or flooding system failure,
yeah.
Right? The problem is when you have a pandemic like this, is it's going to be too infectious for even a smaller group to go to another location and work there. And potentially they may not even be allowed if the government says, right, you have to stop this. So that's why we need to think, well, how much of this now can we do remotely? Why do we actually physically need to go to another site? And this could also be a good time to test out a lot of these cloud service providers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we, you know, one of the benefits now is that we can access all this data from anywhere. We don't have to go to where the server is and so on. But it will also be challenging because ultimately the data providers themselves have to have their servers in certain locations. What happens if those people fall ill? Who's going to maintain them, or can they run remotely themselves? So some interesting questions there. But central banks, we need to think of how we can really continue to let the financial system work.
Yeah, I think last week we had in the news that Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, and a number of large banks actually activated their business continuity plan, and we also had news at the end of last week and earlier this week as well, that a number of central banks and regulatory agencies have actually put in place their own business continuity plan, as well as communicated with the financial sector about the importance of now thinking about business continuity. So I thought that's an excellent point. So if we could wrap things up, because I think it's we have covered some very important points. Just to when I listen, I think leadership, effective communication is a key component of getting through this crisis. So if we could wrap it up, what are those quick points around the kind of leadership, the kind of communication that we should be seeing and having now, both from a central bank perspective, from a private sector banking perspective, and for the wider community as well?
Thanks, Mark. That's a really good question. I think it's really important for central bankers to not overpromise and then underdeliver, not paint too rosy a picture about the situation. Some politicians may be doing that in certain countries, but central bankers are technocrats, and they shouldn't be out there saying, well, everything is going to be all right. You know, there's, instead of saying something like that, explain to the public exactly the steps that are being taken, both on the monetary policy side and on the banking supervision side and on the payments sector side, to give them enough information to reassure them without saying that everything is going to be all right or we're going to get through this really quickly, because we just don't know. You know, there are a lot of uncertainties out there. So the messaging has to be, here's what we're doing, and it's so far what we think we're doing is effective, but we may have to move to stronger actions in the future if the situation worsens.
That's it?
Yeah, so I think that's excellent in terms of what the central banks need to do externally. But I think there's also a role internally for their own staff, right? Because this is a very difficult time. We haven't gone through this situation before. And you want to see that the leadership of the central bank or even a private bank organization actually is doing everything for you, is supportive. So of course we don't know the full extent of how it's going to play out, we don't know all the answers, but you want the kind of the leadership to say, look, this is how it's going to be, we're going to take care of you. If you do fall ill, please stay at home, or if you even suspect you're ill, stay at home, we'll continue to pay your salary. If this and this happens, you can work from home. We're setting up these processes in chain, and potentially we think this is going to be there for some time, so let's make sure the fabric is there to allow that. And I think that kind of support then allows people to at least take some of the concern out of it and continue working, because otherwise you're going to lose the focus and people are going to be more worried about their own situation and their families and so on. So as much as we can, we need to have that
assurance. Okay, good. Thank you. So I believe this was quite an interesting and engaging conversation. If I could just sum up my own takeaway, as central bankers, as regulators, a part of our key consideration is around financial stability and public confidence in the banking system. But this is an unprecedented moment in our history. I mean, certainly in my lifetime. This is a health issue, and it's sad, and we all have to do our best to make sure we get through this as best as we can. So we are conscious from this conversation that we could be seeing scaling down in activities, yet we still have to make very quick decisions. So we have to make sure we have the mechanism in place to be able to address those issues. Thank you very much for listening to the CSEN Center podcast. You can find us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts and other platforms. If you do like our conversations, please leave us a comment or a rating on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. or follow us on Twitter at CSENT Center or email us at podcast@csent.org. Thank you very much, Glenn and Aziz. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.